Empire of the Suns.
Suns.
Empire of the Suns.
Wet like on book. Wet like on book. Wet like on book.
Arizona Sports presents the Empire of the Suns podcast.
Empire of the Suns.
Hello there and welcome to the Empire of the Suns podcast. My name is Kellen Olson, joined as always by Kevin Zimmerman. We are recording this on Tuesday. Is there anything happening today, Kevin?
NFL trade deadline passed. There's really no news to be had here. So
huge Dolphins-Pats trade, right? Okay, we are just like the millions of people in our country right now trying to distract themselves for a little bit, and we are going to do so by talking about the Phoenix Suns basketball organization for, I don't know, like 20, 30, 40 minutes. We don't really set a time on these things. We just kind of hit record and see how long we go. I don't know if you guys have gotten the point of that by now. But we're going to hit on some news. There was actual news that involves the Suns indirectly, but I believe will obviously affect them next season. That is the playoff potential play-in tournament that the league is looking at next year. And then we will hit on some of your questions, which kind of hit on draft-related questions, which kind of hit on a couple of themes that we were going to address today. Anyway, kind of came together like that, eh, Kevin?
It always does.
You know, in a weird way. The story, if you guys haven't seen it, Adrian Wojnarowski and Zach Lowe reporting on ESPN.com about the standstill of the standstill is the best word to use, of the negotiations, whatever you want to call them, between the Players Association and the league, not wanting to start before Christmas, wanting to start before Christmas for these reasons and stuff. Honestly, not something I've been paying too much mind to right now, because I can't potentially stress out about that until today's events are hopefully like over within three to 5 days. And then we'll get to that old anxiety buildup in my melon, at least. Let's start there. Do you, before we get to the play-in tournament and how that affects the Suns, do you actually think this is like something to be worried about? Or is it just, we're going to get one thing, either 72 games or 50 games? Like, we're not headed towards a lockout at all, right? I don't know. I was too young and not as much of a diehard NBA fan as I am now for the last couple of lockouts to really remember how those started before they actually got started, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like the signs to look for. This feels like the signs to me, but I wasn't like informed enough then. What do you think?
I think just comparing it to other leagues right now, you see how like MLB operated around this. You saw the NFL was touch and go. Like, it just seems like Michelle Roberts, Chris Paul, Adam Silver all have a pretty good working relationship where they really want to hammer things out. And obviously, you know, Adam Silver said, we got to get something done. I think that was yesterday. That's kind of obvious. They have a month and a few weeks, maybe, if they want to really get ramped up before Christmas time. But yeah, I think they'll figure it out. And I think when they have a good relationship like this, just a deadline, it really just, you know, they cram for it. Like, we have deadlines in our job. It just forces you to get stuff done. So I feel good about it. I don't know which way they're leaning. Obviously, player safety and getting enough rest and all that is important. So is money, and the players have to make money too. Don't have to, but they want to make money. So I think they're all working in similar interests.
Yeah. The simple thought that I have on it, and I'll allow us to like quickly move on, is that the league believes that they can't afford to start before Christmas. What they really can't afford is not a season happening at all. The dramatic and like kind of whiplash effect of the tables turning, our perspective all of a sudden radically shifting, seemingly out of nowhere, was like, you know what? Yeah, the league has always thought about starting at Christmas to, oh no, they want to get back on the regular schedule really bad. And now it's really about 2021-22 as opposed to this season. This season's kind of a wash anyway. They just want to get back on schedule, and 2021-22 is when they make all their money back. And it was just the agreed upon sentiment of like various national reporters on that kind of just backs up how serious the league is taking it, in my opinion, whenever that kind of thing happens, when you notice reporters from different outlets, similar outlets, whatever it is, kind of sharing the same message together. it's a rather serious thing that they're taking under consideration, that they are absolutely not going to play during the Olympics. They do not want to get slaughtered in the ratings. No, Kevin, they want their players to be able to participate in the Olympics. I'm sorry, I forgot to phrase that that way. That they don't want to get slaughtered by the Olympics and the ratings. And then they obviously want to get off in enough time, have enough off time to get back to like the regular schedule. Hopefully what they were looking at for fans in the building, they've just kind of said, oh, these numbers are not good in a lot of places, that we're not seeing the progress we need. Next year is when we have to really focus on bringing fans back in a full capacity, or much, and not a super strict capacity, that it looks like if we do have fans come back this year, it'll be looking a lot like it is right now in most of the country. There's some weird college football games going on right now. But yeah, I mean,
you also just, you know, emphasize gambling, hard liquor, all of our vices.
And that was amazing.
That will help you make some of that money back. It's simple. It's as simple as that, right? Yeah.
The NBA is like someone who I've not gotten enough sleep to like make a really good analogy here, but basically the plot and the ever living trope in a movie where you owe money by a certain day. And now they're like, oh, the second patch on a jersey? Absolutely. What? We incentivizing gambling, hard alcohol, casinos? Sure. $100 million? Yeah. They're all
purity
of, a sudden
of very, the game.
Yeah, they're all of a sudden very enthusiastic about these ideas that seemingly would tarnish the image of the league. I'm being very dramatic. Of course, it's not really going to tarnish much, but gotta do what you gotta do, Kev. Okay, so let's move on to some questions related to the draft as we kind of keep our draft discussion going. We are a little over 2 weeks away from the draft. Pretty crazy. No real news coming yet. I think it's just going to be I don't want to say there's going to be a ton coming by the start of next week, but I feel like the shift into it really being about the draft league-wide is probably not going to be underway now for another week, and usually the news cycle will oddly reflect that. There's this huge story going on right now that we literally just discussed, which is the league not happening. Kevin, I almost skipped over it. The reason we brought that up in the first place, I caught myself. I'm very proud of myself there for not moving on too soon. The play-in tournament. So here's Woj's report. It is a format that they were considering as early as 2018, and it is basically the 7, 8, 9, and 10 seed at the end of the season will participate in a 4-team play-in. The 7 seed will play the 8 seed, and the 9 seed will play the 10 seed. The winner of the 7-8 seed game gets the 7 seed. The loser of the 7-8 game and the winner of the 9-10 game play each other, and the winner gets the 8 seed. So if you're in the 9-10 region, you have to win twice to get in. But if you're in the 7-8, you can just go 1-1 and still make it. I kind of tweeted a mini thread on this, and like, this is obviously significant news for the Suns, but do you think it actually will shift their off-season thinking at all? Do you think that it will be kind of more urgency, less urgency? What do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, tell me what move they could make that would really jump them into the top six. That's the question you have to ask. Seven, correct. 8, 9, 10. I think that's kind of where they're kind of projecting and hoping to be right now. With a few upgrades, I think if you got even a lot better, you would still maybe only hit 7. So I don't think it really changes. It obviously helps them if they don't, if it's just that competitive, which, you know, we can all expect it to be in the West, then that's obviously a huge deal, and they don't have to rush as much, I guess. If you really do think you need to make a drastic move, I think maybe this lessens the, I guess, urgency to maybe take something that's more risky that's on the table and, you know, trade Oubre for someone who maybe isn't the greatest fit but is a good player or something like that.
Right. That's a really smart way of kind of outlining it and kind of simplifying it before people get really too deep into thought about this. And we'll have a podcast episode like after our offseason reactions where we kind of look at the way the West has shifted. So a lot of things could change right now, but with that in mind, I think everyone listening can agree that the Lakers, Clippers, Warriors, and Nuggets are pretty much absolute locks to make the playoffs. I really don't see how any of those four teams don't make the playoffs without significant injuries derailing their season. I believe that you should throw Houston in here. I will say that with Morey gone and with D'Antoni gone, there is enough shifting that has occurred that could lead to some spiraling. And then it's a matter of like, do they need to trade Westbrook or Harden? Do they really need to blow this thing up? But I mean, those two guys are the key. They have Russell Westbrook and James Harden in a regular season. They are going to destroy teams a lot of nights, and they are still going to be a very good small ball kind of team. And then I believe with Luka, Dallas deserves to be in that group as well, especially with what he showed last year and the way that he kind of, I don't want to say carried that team, but had them do well. They've got some money. Now they have to be careful with how they use it because they want to keep themselves open as a team for Giannis. But with that in mind, they are going to have Luka and some more help for him, which I think is needed. I think that team was always a guy or two shy. I was also just, in my opinion, Kevin, guys like Tim Hardaway, and a few others in that series, Dorian Finney-Smith, I think really proved a lot in that Clipper series that they're like legitimate. They're not just, it's not just Luka and a bunch of scrubs that he's carrying. Like these are legitimate rotation level players for the playoffs that played well in those games that matters for them. So I think those six teams without a doubt are in there. And I agree with you that you have to look at it from the Suns' perspective and say, okay, how do they reach those six teams in terms of making a move? I think it's, as always, I think it's just going to come down to how their own youth develops. I think it would basically have to be the guy you draft at 10 is, which we'll get into in a bit. The guy you draft at 10 is like an instant impact guy that helps your team get better dramatically. And let's just say, let's just make this convenient. The guy you draft at 10 is Haliburton. It turns out he's either the best player in this class or one of the three best, and he's the rookie of the year off the bench, which would be rather convenient, or that would have to be convenient for him, but let's just go with that. He's that good, and that all of a sudden fixes your humongous problem, which was whenever Rubio or Booker comes off the court, Haliburton comes in, that patches that up. You make a smart free agent signing or two. There's no more third guard because that's Haliburton. Let's say you add another forward. It's Grant, it's Bertans, it's whoever it is. You add the four forwards. You have Ayton and Saric, whatever it is. And Ayton plays at an all-star level next year. Book plays at a better level like we expect him to. Johnson and Bridges improve a little bit. Okay, now you're talking about a legitimate like 50-win team at that point. A 50 to 55 win team, and that's where you can legitimately say like maybe they're in the top six at that point. But even then, Kevin, there's going to be parity in the West, but even then, I don't know if you could absolutely for sure say that all that adds up to a team that finishes in the top six and you avoid this 7, 8, 9, 10 mess. Because what I didn't mention yet is, again, we'll review it in a couple of weeks when everything changes, but Utah, OKC, Portland, Memphis, New Orleans, San Antonio, I think all have to be at least mentioned right now. OKC might really dramatically shift things. We'll see how the Spurs look. I think they're a really interesting team to keep an eye on. But obviously, Portland and Memphis and New Orleans are going to be in that mix with the Suns as well. So I just don't see how they kind of – it's – is it too much to, like, narratively say, Kevin? Like, I think it's kind of their destiny to be in this play-in if they do – make it. Like, I think that their road to the playoffs is going to have to come through this play-in, I think, if they make the playoffs.
And then you consider if it's that reduced of a schedule, assuming that they want to keep a regional, which would be the smart thing to do, you are in a division if they do it that way with the two LA teams who should, again, be contenders, the Golden State Warriors, or the Golden State Warriors again, we assume. The Kings aren't terrible. So just numbers wise, that's going to be tough.
Could very well be the three best teams in the league that you're playing the most against in the Kings.
Yep.
It's a good point, man. There's just so much more that we have left to kind of like discover and kind of figure out in terms of projecting next season. But that's all we can do is project for now. So we'll move on the conversation to your questions. Shout out to all of you who jokingly asked a question on brand for the podcast. I really do appreciate it, sticking with the themes here, but at the same time, we're trying to do something here. So we really appreciate your jokes, but when half of the replies are jokes, it doesn't help us much. So maybe get your joke in, fired off. Like, listen, Mr. Fan Club over at the Sun Official Aaron Baines headquarters, he's allowed to make as many joke replies as he wants because he is the king. She is the king queen. Have we confirmed a gender over there? I don't want to like put it in a box. I'm talking myself into a corner. Allow that person to make as many jokes as they want. But I'm just going to be a dad here and just say like, come on people, like, help us out a little bit. We're trying to get something done here, but we did get some questions in there with that in mind. And we'll kind of stick to like three general discussion points. And the first one is going through two different questions. Andrew Cabani asked, If Killian Hayes is going to drop to 8 or 9, what type of package is needed to jump up 2 spots? Do the Knicks ever trade back? And then Joe Frick asked, is there a guy that looks like they won't last until pick 10 that you would seriously consider moving up to get? The timing of us bringing up these questions is pertinent, I guess, to today, because Kevin O'Connor on The Ringer released his new NBA mock draft, which he has Anthony Edwards going 1, Wiseman 2, Okongwu 3 to the Hornets, Abdia going 4 to the Bulls, and then Isaac Okoro going to the Cavaliers, which means after the top 5, you've got LaMelo Ball, Tyrese Halliburton on the board, and Killian Hayes, but then he has all 3 of those guys going in order, 6, 7, 8, Bissell going 9 to the Hawks, and then he has the Suns taking Kyra Lewis at number 10. We can hit on like the Oubre. It seems like the Warriors fan base and their own boredom on their own has like really made this Oubre for number 2 thing happen. Like, it hasn't been legitimately reported or anything close to that anywhere, but everyone knows like this Oubre for number 2 thing. It gets brought up to me all the time, just seemingly because the Warriors fans have talked about it on Twitter enough. And they know that like Oubre could potentially get dealt with, which helps out that discussion point. But I don't know, Kevin, where do you, I guess we can only say it from our perspective because we don't have enough. We know James Jones traded back. I don't know. Do you have an impression that he would trade up in a draft? It doesn't really align with their asset strategy, or does it? I don't know. He's burned assets before to get rid of guys. Would he burn assets to get guys? What would the assets be? I don't know. Trading up is always a difficult thing to talk about, right?
I think, yeah. I mean, I'd have to look at a history of just what it takes. I think moving up 2 spots in this draft doesn't make sense just because, like, if you're the Suns, I think that you would like at least one or more than one guy. I mean, at number 10, where you don't feel like I have to move up to get my guy at 8. But if we're talking like 5, 4, 3, even 2, maybe that's a future pick and a starting caliber player. Like, I just don't know. And especially because everyone values these guys so differently, I'm not sure you want to get swindled like that just because these guys, as we've talked about, are so scary. For the most part, they all have their red flags and you don't know how they're going to pan out. So I just think it would really surprise me if they're going to be that aggressive to move up, unless it's a really stunningly small package, I guess, as far as return. Like, if it's a future first and you get to move up 2 or 3 spots, maybe you do it. And maybe that's worth it for another team just to get another asset and slide back just a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. It's tough. And as far as giving up a guy like Oubre, I that would scare me in this, and I would be surprised, I guess, too, to see James Jones to like make that risky of a move, a proven starter for who knows, you know.
A lot of people just ask, like, what can you say in terms of like trading up, how much it would cost, or trading down, how much you could get. That is quite honestly impossible to gauge. Even if you go back and look at the recent history of what was given up and all that kind of stuff, these specific trades come so much more down to what a team wants. And what the Suns wanted last year was they wanted Cam Johnson, and they wanted to find a solution to this problem, which was they were looking at an opening day power forward position that was going to be seemingly empty. This was before like Oubre and Bridges were thought of as guys that could play there, but they just didn't really have anyone there at all. And then they just get Dario Saric, and they get Dario Saric on a price of like $4 million that won't really hurt their cap sheet too much. So they can still get him and look at free agency coming in the next couple of days and say, okay, we can still go get a guy for $15 to $20 million because we can make this Josh Jackson trade a little bit later, and so on. So I don't really know how to answer the question. I will ask you this, Kevin, if this kind of situation unfolds and you're looking at one of Ball, Halliburton, or Hayes is available in like 3 or 4 spots, and you know that they're going to be gone, that none of them are going to be there when the Suns are up at number 10, would you give up a asset to do so? And I think the only way to talk about it is a future pick, because there's nobody like on the team. Like, moving up like 4 spots and trading Oubre makes 0 sense at all. That's stupid. I don't care. as someone who rates Ball highly, I would not even do that for Ball. He's just too much of a risk to give up Oubre for, even if it's only a year of Oubre playing. There's no one really on the roster. Like the trade that O'Connor has is Washington moving from 9 to 6, and he has Washington giving up 9, 37 and Troy Brown Jr. for number 6. The Suns don't really have second round picks to give up. Already they don't have one in this year's draft. And then I believe they don't have next year's or the year after. I'm pretty sure it's next year's, from the Memphis trade. And it has to come down to future picks. So I guess the question I'll ask you is, if this situation unfolds and you're looking at your pick of Ball, Halliburton, or Hayes at 6, would you give up next year's first round pick to do so? What protections would you need on that pick in order to pull the trigger on that type of deal?
Yeah. I also don't know if, can you throw in like Elie Kobo? Cause I don't know.
Someone would have to like
dates.
Isn't that one of those things where they know that the team's going to waive him? Like they know the Suns are going to get rid of him. So they wouldn't even like care if he was thrown in.
Yeah. I mean, if they like him, I mean,
it's true.
Then they can pick up his option is my thought. I don't know how this off season's working, honestly, but I would throw something like him in, and then you get a first that's top 10 protected, top 12 protected, maybe lottery protected, something like that, just to be a little safe. But yeah, I mean, that's, I think if Halliburton was on the board at say 6, if you really like him, I wouldn't completely hate giving up a first. I mean, that's protected. I don't think that's a bad move. If you're sure, and it has to be a guy you're pretty sure on, like we've said, he's one. A Kongwu would be another, where I just think it's too good of a player, but they don't really need him, so that doesn't make sense either. That's about it, I would say.
I agree. I would go lottery protected first. I think I would do it. Because at that point, you're pretty much locked in on Rubio, Booker, point guard of the future, who's your third guard, Bridges, Johnson, Ayton. You've got those six, to name six guys. Those six guys is like your young core, and you can like afford to give up that pick in the future. I think that's okay. So much of this depends on like who do they like at 10. If they really like Nesmith or Lewis or one of these guys, how much of a gap do they see between Lewis and Ball, or Lewis and Halliburton, or Lewis and Hayes? Like that kind of discussion has to be had. So I don't really know how to answer that, but we were getting the question so much that we thought we would kind of bring it up and kind of have the trade up, trade down discussion right now, which we did. I thought it went well, Kevin. How about you?
I'm just curious. Like, I know some teams have an actual analytical, like, this is the value of things that we should give up for this move.
Yeah.
I don't think this front office has that, though. Like, I'm sure Ryan McDonough's, like, and like NFL teams have this, like, okay, a fourth round and a sixth round pick for like a fourth or something, or a third or something like that. Like, they have like actual sliding scales where you can just do quick math and be like, that's the same value. That's a good trade. I don't think this front office has stuff like that. I could be wrong, but they have not operated like that in the past.
I agree. It's hilarious how it actually does. There is such a vast difference in the way people approach these things, especially with the numbers. Like you said, that's a really cool way of putting it. Our next question comes from David Pauli. It's probably Pauli. I'm sorry, David. I'm very at Broncos boy 4619. That's okay. That was somehow worse. Should we be concerned about the video that came out of Devin Vassell's jump shot mechanics? We did not talk about this on the podcast yet, Kevin. Vassell already has kind of a unique overhead shot anyway, but it looked like on the videos that he was bringing it back even further, and it was kind of one of those scary pre-draft videos. With that being said, I have never ever been the type to react to in between the end of the college international season and the draft. I've never been one to react to any sort of videos in empty gyms. Now, there was a video of Jason Tatum in an empty gym sinking three after three after three after three that I shrugged off, and that turned out to be one to pay attention to, but there are other ones that don't look as good. But is this a concerning thing? I wrote about this just a smidge and just basically said, with what happened to Mikel and the hitch that he added, it has to at least trigger something for Suns fans. I think that's as far as I'm willing to go, though.
Yeah, it does matter sometimes, but I would just say, have you read anything about people being concerned about it? Because, like, I know Schmitz and those guys have gone to these workouts. They have LA workouts with like four or five prospects at a time. And you do get some things as takeaways from those, even if they're not being defended by anyone. But I'm assuming he's done something in front of scouts and NBA players, at least those combine videos that they distribute. And if you're not hearing anything where it's like super concerning, then I wouldn't put a lot of stock into it. But then again, like, the Mikel thing was real. We saw that in games. We saw it when we would go after practices and he'd be getting up shots where he was trying to get it out. And then he talked about it. So the off season workout thing is super interesting to me just in general, because we can go back to like Lute Olson days where he like complained about, I don't know if you remember Marcus Williams, his shot. He's just like, someone messed with his shot this summer and it wasn't good. That stuff happens. So it's really a matter of like, did he go to like someone who's not going to like mess him up and tell him all he needs all this when it's like, he was already a good shooter, man. You know,
you can't react too much to just a 10-second video. It could have been his shot looked weird, just those two attempts, you know? I don't know. Yeah. I think you're just better off not really reacting. But I want to transition bringing up Vassell, because Vassell's 3-and-D skills and just some of the overall appeal for him is being NBA ready. Kevin, who are some of the prospects you look at that they could potentially take at number 10? Where do you rate that pick in terms of how ready these guys are to contribute? And I want to preface, before you answer, I want to preface this with just, it's very fascinating because there's a good chance they're going to take a point guard, and they seriously, I've been saying from the rooftop that third guard should be their number one concern this entire offseason. That has not changed. Even if like Oubre wanted a trade or like whatever could potentially go wrong or like really shift your dynamic or your priorities this offseason is a better way to put it. Or you have a serious shot at a big name free agent that's a power forward or whatever, this huge trade emerges. I just still think that third guard is the most important thing with what went wrong last season. So like, say you draft Killian Hayes, does that mean you should just roll with Killian Hayes, Javon Carter, Cameron Payne as like your reserve backcourt? Should you sign someone else? How do you feel about that position in the draft overall in terms of a guy that's ready to play right now and how it could look for the Suns?
Third guard's tougher, because I honestly think like you could find minutes for a wing who can slide to the four, obviously power forwards. When you get down to the guys that you really want at third guard, you want playmaking, you want scoring, you want ball handling, right? And it's tough for me to see Haliburton, Hayes, you know, those two guys, one of them falling. I really have a tough time seeing that. And that's where it's tough for the Suns, because after those two, it's really like, okay, do you think like Cole Anthony can do these things? We've discussed like he has these red flags. He's not efficient. Does he fit like this team and what they want as far as personality and being unselfish and all that stuff? Like, there are a lot of questions there. I think Lewis is the interesting one. O'Connor had him going 10 for the Suns, and even over guys like Obi Toppin, because he really does fit. Like, we know he can make enough plays. He's obviously going to change a game as like a changeup, just a guy who can speed things up on other teams and attack and take pressure off Book, or just flat out be on the floor and be that scorer when Book's not out there. So I think that's where Lewis kind of comes in as that guy where I wouldn't feel necessarily worried about him. Like, I feel less worried about him than I do Cole Anthony or Tyrese Maxey, honestly. And I think he could grow into you know, a future starting point guard. So that's what they got to judge. It's like, do you want just a third guard for the next 2 years, or do you really want to go out there and get your, you know, Rubio replacement?
Oh, that's interesting. Do you really think it goes that far with this group? Like, do you think that Haliburton is more of a short-sighted selection if he's there?
I mean, no, if he's there, I think he's both. Fits that mold. Yeah, I think
who do you feel like on the spectrum of, as opposed to short-sighted versus long-term, where do you go?
Are you saying like who do you think is short-term more?
Yeah.
Yeah,
who do you think is the guy that you're drafting right now because he's better and you're potentially giving up more upside that these other guys could have? Like you mentioned Maxey, for example, as a long-term guy, and I agree that there's some potential there for sure.
No, I mean, I think Cole Anthony's the guy where I don't know long-term if he's the right fit. That's what I mean. I don't know if Maxey's the point guard either, because he just didn't play it enough for me to say that guy could be an NBA caliber starting point guard. So I think those two guys are where I pause. Just, I don't know, man. It's tough to see. Like, I think they could contribute right away, maybe, but I don't know if they can contribute after Rubio's done here on his contract.
Yeah. I really don't know how to answer this question. And it's funny because I was the one who kind of brought it up and wanted to talk about it. When we were like outlining the show before this, if I had to look at outside of the three guys and just rank them by like guys that would be the most ready to play, I think part of how you have to look at it is, okay, if they draft Desmond Bane at 10, am I picturing him in a play now role of 12 to 18 minutes a la Cam? The thing that people have to like, you have to go before the bubble and remember that Cam was a guy who really didn't play that much at the start of the season. And Monty basically had him on a 10 to 25 minute stretch where if he didn't look that good and he was doing rookie stuff, he played like 8 to 14 minutes. But if he was rolling a little bit and looked good, or there were other things in the game that were trending a specific way with matchups or whatever, Cam was playing 20 to 25 minutes, maybe even 30 on some nights. But before he really got going and starting, or just before he started in the bubble, I think he only played over 25 minutes in like 5, 6, 7 games. It wasn't that many at all. He did not play that much last year. So everyone thinks of it like being another guy like Cam. Well, Cam didn't really play that much. So is Bane that type of guy? Is that with Oubre in the picture? I think Oubre is the guy that you have to bring up when we talk about this potential guy. I would bring up Abdia, but I'm getting the feeling more by the day that he's going to go in the top five. I really thought that there was maybe going to be some, I don't know if like international bias is the right way I'm going for, but just like some reason teams would overlook him. But I'm starting to get the sense less and less by the day that teams, it's actually the opposite. They're looking at everything wrong with this class and they just feel more safe about him, which I think is the correct approach for someone picking in the top five when looking at him. Okongwu is obviously a guy I feel like about this, but I think I'm talking about all these guys who are going to be gone by the time they pick. I think that I'll say this. I think that if it's Hayes, if it's not Bane, Haliburton, and like I'll just bring up Riller because I have him ranked so high, I really don't think he's going to come up at all. But I think outside of those three guys, I hesitate as to relying on that player to play an actual role. And even if it is like 12 to 15 minutes as the fourth forward slash wing slash whatever, someone like Nesmith, for example, like if they keep Oubre, or someone like Patrick Williams or even Vassell, I hesitate a little bit more to relying on them in an actual role. That's really not what Cam was, because he was, if he had a really reliable defined role, he would have been playing 20 minutes a night every single night. It fluctuated based on what was happening. Outside of those three guys, I think it does go anywhere. I guess the question that I really don't know the answer to is, if they take Haliburton at 10, Kevin, are you still going after a third guard, or are you just going to really bank on the rookie and say, this is our guy? And if he's not, we still have campaign.
Yeah, I actually think, kind of tying this to the power forward thing, honestly don't think the third guard is as big of a deal if those guys are off the board. If it's Haliburton, like you roll with it and you figure it out. But if it's like Cole Anthony, whatever, like what if campaign is just that good as he was in the bubble? I know he's not going to shoot those percentages, but he's not going to make rookie mistakes. He's going to play defense. He's going to run the second unit. Like, it's not a huge deal if that third guard, if you draft one, just isn't really ready to develop. So I don't think playing time is that big of a deal for that position. But I think there's more opportunity with the power forward where, like, we expect Kaminsky, Saric, Baines, not all of them are going to be back, maybe one of them. So if they went big, I think a big would actually have more opportunity to sneak some minutes in, whether it's in small lineups, whether they just got to go a little bigger. But yeah, obviously the wings are going to eat up a lot of minutes there too. So I really think they should put thought into long-term stuff. And that's what I'm kind of struggling to say, maybe, is like, I don't know if Cole Anthony's going to be it, but I actually see a lot of guys with higher upside than him, who I think they should consider just to prep for a few years down the road.
Right. Looking at my like list of just like my own board, I would say someone like Lewis, Patrick Williams, Nesmith, obviously, Maxey, Anthony are guys you brought up. I really do think that after that, you have to look at it differently. Like, if they draft Kyra Lewis, I think they should still be very aggressive in looking for a third guard, whether that's like a trade candidate like Luke Kennard, like I wrote about, or it's a mid-level guy, Langston Galloway, someone a little bit more expensive, DJ Augustine, Jeff Teague, some veteran. I would really look for that. And I think Lewis is good at a lot of stuff, but I would feel nervous about handing the second unit off to him, because I really do feel like it's a huge, huge part of their success. I really don't see how the Suns aren't a above 500 team if they're playing well when that third guard is on the court. I really do. It would have to take like Rubio going way downhill and out of nowhere, really, for that to not be a thing. It would be a strange universe for me. The final question we'll go on here to kind of wrap up is, David Nash asked, who's the guy no one is focused on that makes the most sense for the Suns to take, a la Cam Johnson? I think the way that this question is addressed, we should kind of rule a couple names out that we've talked about quite a bit. So Kyra Lewis is a guy who's he's ranked like outside the top 15 on most boards. But we talk about him a ton. We talk about Desmond Bane a ton. I've talked about Grant Riller a ton. So going outside of those names, someone you're not seeing on Twitter as much linked to the Suns, who's your guy, Kevin, that you want Suns fans to keep an eye on?
I've said it already. I think Sadiq Bey just makes a lot of sense. Is a guy who that they would like just because of his personality. He seems like a really good kid, really smart basketball player, can play make off the bounce. I love his size. Like, he's kind of a tweener, I guess. He is a wing, but I think he has the girth to be a power forward. Kind of like Draymond. I don't think he's quite as long as Draymond, but he does have length to him. Can shoot, make the right pass, just play hard defense, even though he's not the best athlete. I just think it makes sense. Personality fit, it makes sense. Skill set, he's not terrible at anything, really. And I like him, and that's why I think I've said this a million times, been on that train for a long time.
I got three names for you. I agree. I got three. One I'll mention quickly is Bulmaro from overseas. I talked about him last episode, and I brought him up enough to the point where I just kind of can reference our past discussions, and that's like my guy, quote unquote. One guy that we just wrote about on the site, and we should promote that we have a 5x5 series, which is looking at 25 total players. Hopefully, one of those 25 players is the guy the Suns wind up taking.
We just whiff.
The fact that we can still potentially miss tells you something about this draft class, and particularly. But one guy I brought up that we haven't talked about one bit, and we didn't even talk about when we were bringing up the wings on our preview podcast, was Robert Woodard, who's a guard/forward. He played at Mississippi State. In his sophomore year, he averaged 11-6-1-1-1. Shot 49% from the field. He shot 43% from three, but that's a huge asterisk next to that. because in two seasons at Mississippi State, he shot 62% from the line, and he only took 2.3 threes last season. And then the season before that, he shot 27% on just 44 total attempts. So he is still a developmental shooter, but he's 6'7", 7'1", wingspan. The way that I described him as an athlete is that he isn't just uber explosive, but he also doesn't lack like pop and like that kind of explosiveness. He's kind of somewhere in the middle. Like if you give him time on one or two feet to kind of get going and explode at the rim, he's going to do that. He can finish well. He makes a lot of really smart team plays. I really liked his team defense quite a bit. There's a clip in our post today where he's just like, he makes like three different plays in 4 seconds. And it's kind of the line I put there is like, if you guys talk about team defense all the time and you're like wondering what that actually looks like individually, like this is it, like this string of possessions, string of plays together in one possession that he makes. The problem here is shooting. But in terms of like a smart player who can kind of handle the ball like a little bit and kind of goes up and down the charts a little bit slow athletically. I think the way that I tweeted Max Carlin and Ben Pfeiffer, who are two of the best draft guys on Twitter. I tweeted them. I was like, I haven't seen like any Robert Woodard stuff. Like, is there a Robert Woodard guy on here that loves Robert Woodard? I feel like there should be, because this is just like another smart somewhere in the vein of Bay, Desmond Bain, Vassell. This is the smart team play defense kind of guy that everyone loves. Is there anyone who likes him? And Max described him well as kind of like, he's just a little bit slower in like every phase than you would like him to be. Like he's a step slower athletically. He's a step slow in terms of like how he sees the floor. And he's a step slow in terms of his decisions as a ball handler. It's not like a negative, but it's just, he's not quite as hyper advanced maybe in that regard as like some of those other guys are with being a little bit quicker on a variety of things, but he is absolutely like a guy who checks a few of the boxes. And then the last name I'll bring up is Isaiah Joe out of Arkansas, who's another guy that we didn't bring up, but again, it is a guy who you watch games, and I think I got through two Arkansas games, like two and a half. So again, like limited sample size for me, but everything I heard about him backed up on the tape, which was that smart guy makes plays. You really trust him to shoot. That's the thing that I should mention from him. So 6'5 guard, he shot 34% from three last year, which isn't that great. But here's the thing, Kevin, he took 10.6 a game. 10.6, Kevin. He took 275 threes last year. 275. He took 8 threes a game last year and made 41% of them. Averaged a steal and a half a game last year and the year before, 1.7 assists, 4 rebounds a game this year, 17 points a game this year. He only shot 36.7% from the field. But again, Kevin, he took 10.6 threes and only 13.8 shots. So like 70% of his shots were threes. So he was like, he had a very defined role for Arkansas and they were willing to let him shoot. And like those numbers might be underselling how good of a shooter he is with how much he shot the ball. But the Cam Johnson, like make a good decision in a dribble or two and make the pass or the cut or whatever it is. He does that stuff. And if the Suns trade back, I'm obviously going to be thinking of Bain and Riller, but I think Joe might be one of the first names that comes to mind for me. Like if they just even go down to like 16 or something or 20 and do that kind of thing again, he's going to be one of the first names that comes up to me. He's very interesting. Have you heard anything about him?
I just know that he has two first names.
Oh, that's going to be like the draft analysis card. And when they pick him, we're going to be like, here's two name guy. Fun player comps for the Ringer: Luke Kennard, Alan Crabb, and RJ Hunter. How about that? Just because I like broadly went in, I'll kind of just, I'm sure like a couple of people are now intrigued by him. I'll give you the full rundown that O'Connor has on his board. Versatile shooter with deep range off of full sprint and off screens. He knows how to cut and relocate. Effective marksman off the dribble. Displays great touch around the rim. Solid passer. Great fundamentals and lateral quickness on the defensive end, which make him effective on ball despite a lack of strength. Energetic off-ball defender. He added inconsistent shooter for the minuses. But he abbreviated that like he took a lot of difficult shots because Arkansas wanted him to chuck, and he had the over 10 three-point attempts per game. And then that kind of adds into the negatives O'Connor gets on to, which is like, okay, now you're worried about shot selection potentially because he's just jacking everything. And he had a knee surgery, it looks like, that ended his sophomore season early. And you're talking about a guy who's 6'5", 180 with, like, not very long arms. 21 years old, though, a little bit developed. So Isaiah Joe, that's my name. And, like, Kevin, if we
– Two names.
If the two first names, but the one name to bring it to 26 total. We didn't even get to him in our 25. But if we didn't get it with those 26 guys and we still didn't get the guy that they drafted, I don't know, man. I don't know what else we're supposed to do. We'll just, like, sacrifice our, like – we'll just tell James Jones, like, we give up, man. Like, we're done previewing the draft for you. Or just
tell us who to look after. You know, like, just give us the tip and we won't spoil it, but just so we don't look like idiots next time. Yeah.
I think they would. I think they'd love to see us look like idiots. Just like someone who fun Google, if you're still listening. I think everyone's still listening at this point. Doesn't hate me. Just Google, like, Cam Johnson, Ty Jerome, Arizona Sports, and look up my draft day read. I eviscerated the Suns for those two selections, and particularly just said, like, this was a horrible first draft for James Jones. Boy, was I wrong, Kev, and boy, do I look stupid for being that wrong. But, hey, that's part of the business, you know? You're right and wrong on some stuff, and, boy, do I say this enough? I'm glad I was wrong because Cam Johnson's fun to watch, and they're very lucky to have him. What are your plans for the rest of the day, Kevin? How are you going to spend it? Just let's end it there. All right, everyone. Yeah. We'll be back next week. Hopefully we're in a better mood than we are right now. I think it's going to be I'm impossible, hopefully. Oh, man, that's kind of foreboding, I guess, but that's the kind of day it is today. All right, bye, everyone.